Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Sarah Wheelock, Judge John Smith, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A210495, Pamela Delice Skeens versus Adele Bakir.
Good morning. Thank you for appearing this way and participating in our remote arguments today. The same rules will apply as if we were in the judicial center. But before we begin, I want to make a couple of comments. First off, please state your name before you begin your argument and the party that you represent, because we are making an audio recording of the hearings today. In addition, we ask that you mute yourselves when you're not speaking. I would note that the only participants who can speak or whose screens can be viewed are the judges and the attorneys who are arguing the cases. We also understand that from time to time, there might be interruptions or technical problems or doorbells and pets and whatnot. We will try to keep those to a minimum. We ask that you do the same, but we do understand that that these things can occur. We'll make sure to accommodate any issues that you might have to so that you have the full time to which you're entitled. And last, I will make a comment about the clock. If you are in active speaker view, sometimes it's that the time, the clock is really small, so it's hard to see. So if you make sure that you're in gallery view before you begin and that you can see where that clock is, then you'll know how much time is remaining. And with that, Ms. Hunt, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynord Hunt, and I represent the appellant, Pamela Skeens. Appellant is before the court this morning seeking reversal of the trial court's denial to her of continued spousal maintenance and need-based fees. Appellant's inability to become self-supporting is a substantially increased need under the modification statute and renders the termination of spousal maintenance unreasonable and unfair. As one court stated, unlike a broken arm, a mind cannot be x-rayed. Such is the nature of psychiatry. Appellant's mental health problems, coupled with other medical problems, are undisputed. The medical evidence of record is that appellant suffers from a constellation of diagnosed psychological conditions for which appellant has been seeking treatment, coupled with other well-documented medical problems that prevent appellant age 58 at the time of modification motion from being able to be employed on either a full-time or a part-time basis. Not only is this the opinion of appellant's treating psychiatrist who appellant sees on a regular basis, but appellant's vocational expert, after conducting his own testing and investigation, reached the same conclusion, stating definitively that appellant, quote, is impaired from any and all employment. There is no expert testimony, medical or vocational, to contradict that evidence. Any failure to now become self-sufficient cannot be characterized as voluntary or willful or lacking reasonable effort. Any expectation that appellant has the ability to become self-sufficient has no basis in the record. Nonetheless, on this record, the trial court states as fact that the court was not presented with any evidence restricting appellant's achievement of employment. The trial court finds appellant should be employed full-time, and there is no reason for her unemployment now other than lack of effort. According to the trial court, appellant has the ability to work now despite her medical conditions, and that her failure to work, as the trial court views it, is one of being unemployed in bad faith. That and a multitude of similar findings are clearly erroneous. Of special concern here is the trial court's apparent rejection without any medical basis that anxiety, depression, PTSD do not impact one's ability to work, and specifically did not impact appellant's ability to work. The trial court at times zeroes in on appellant's physical health, being dismissive of her mental health. The trial court goes so far as to play doctor and expresses the opinion that some unknown other adults experience the same symptoms and are able to maintain self-sufficiency, so why can't appellant? The trial court, by ignoring what appellant's treating psychiatrist actually says and cherry-picking the record, somehow concludes appellant is improving, that she's treatable, and her condition is far from debilitating, and she has the present ability to work and be self-supporting. But in fact, appellant and her medical records are replete with evidence of appellant's panic attacks and physical illnesses that are stress-related psychiatric conditions, such as Barrett's esophagus. The trial court's refusal to recognize the impact of appellant's well-documented mental conditions, coupled with her physical conditions as recognized in the vocational assessment, is clear error. Now, the trial court is adamant that appellant did not submit evidence that she even applied for jobs or looked for jobs for which she was qualified. Those findings are clearly erroneous. One of appellant's job experiences shortly after marriage was as a high-level sales manager in the marine industry, from which she was terminated in 1996. In 2015, appellant took a sales position with Jupiter Marine. The undisputed fact of record is that appellant could not master the technical aspects of the sales position. This is so even after she took a refresher course on computers. She could not focus and concentrate on her work, and she simply could not do the job. And there's no question that this position was akin to appellant's previous field in the 1990s, but at a lower level, but appellant could not do this job. The trial court nonetheless states that this was not a reasonable attempt at rehabilitation because this job involved high levels of stress and expertise that appellant had not acquired. But appellant's high-level sales manager position at Greentree from 1994 to 1996, which the trial court appears to view as one which appellant was somehow still qualified for, was a position in sales. And even respondent admitted this job, from which appellant was terminated in 1996, was an extremely high-stress position. If appellant could not function in her 2015 employment at Jupiter Marine, the trial court simply cannot conclude on this record that appellant could perform employment as she did in the 1990s and where she had her highest earnings, nor that wife can somehow function in the field of finance given her inability to concentrate or that somehow is less stressful. Again, respondent presented no vocational assessment that appellant has the ability to be employed anywhere. And the only vocational assessment of record is that she cannot. The vocational assessment and the psychiatrist answer the questions that appellant cannot work. What if appellant had a brain tumor and her neurosurgeon says it affects her cognitive abilities and she can't work? Would the court care if she had not sought additional training or applied for more jobs that she cannot do? The results shouldn't be any different here, where appellant's psychiatrist says because of her mental conditions, she cannot work. There simply is no basis for the trial court's findings of appellant's employability other than rank speculation, and it is contrary to the undisputed facts of record. Wife's health simply prevents her from such employment. The trial court additionally finds that appellant, in addition to her failure to rehabilitate, did very little to save and invest, which, according to the trial court, also evidences bad faith. That ignores the fact that the bulk of what appellant was to receive was in the form of spousal maintenance. If you look at the divorce decree, appellant received very little in property in the divorce decree, aside from $69,000 in home equity, $23,000 in an IRA. And she went years without bonus share per the judgment and decree. And because of the reduction, because of respondent's job situation, she didn't receive $312,000 of spousal maintenance as originally agreed to. That's a denial of almost 5 years of spousal maintenance at the $6,000 a month level. There is reason that due to respondent's non-payment that appellant simply could not save. So on this record, appellant is asking that this court reverse the district court's denial to her of continued spousal maintenance. Briefly, I just want to mention the need-based attorney's fees. The trial court's denial is based on the trial court's findings that appellant didn't make a good faith assertion of her rights, but appellant submitted expert support. So clearly she had the right to make the motion. She has support for her motion. And even if the court were to somehow conclude contrary to the record that the trial court was correct as to the spousal maintenance, she still was entitled to need-based fees. Respondent has the ability to pay these fees. An appellant has no source of income. She has no income now. She has spent down what she has. She meets the standard of need-based fees and was abuse of discretion to deny them. So appellant also requests that the court reverse and order that need-based fees be awarded.
All right. I don't see questions coming from the members of the panel. I don't have questions. I thank you for your argument. We will have some time remaining for rebuttal. Ms. Nordin.
Thank you. I'm Rosalyn Nordin. I'm the attorney for respondent, Mr. Beck, here. And we are here asking that this court affirm the order from February 22, 2021. This order is based upon a very, very thorough review of the entire record in this matter, dating back to the party's divorce. It's very rare to see an order that has 65 pages, 226 findings, 76 footnotes, and all of those findings, all of those footnotes are references back to the record and the fact that the judge thoroughly reviewed that entire record. I refer the court to the standard of review in this matter, which is, has the trial court abused its discretion? We have a stipulated decree from December of 2008 that very clearly set out the intent of the parties that the appellant was to receive temporary spousal maintenance. There is an express finding that in fact says that she is to be entitled to temporary spousal maintenance only. What Judge Brown did in her review of the entire record was look at the what was originally a 14-year term reduced to a 12-year term, and what were the efforts of the appellant to actually meet the requirements, meet the duty of rehabilitation that is very clear in Minnesota case law. Now, during that history of those 14 or 12 years, these parties did return to court, did meet and have stipulations entered, where in fact there were modifications to the amount of the spousal maintenance due to, first of all, my client's unemployment situations, significantly reduced income, and then later, because his income had gone up, the appellant's effort, successful effort to increase the spousal maintenance again. What was never touched was the term of that temporary spousal maintenance, with one exception, which was consideration given of an $84,000 lump sum payment in 2009, when that term was reduced by 2 years. So what the judge in the lower court did was, in her analysis, in those extraordinary number of findings, look at the record for, did this appellant meet her burden, her duty, to rehabilitate and make an effort to get a job, get some kind of employment. And her conclusion was, based upon everything she saw, no, that did not happen. And in that review, she did spend time dealing with the fact that this was a stipulated decree, that there was an intent from both sides in this matter that Ms. Skeens would in fact become self-supporting, or at least make efforts of that. And by the end of the term, when this motion was brought before Judge Brown, in fact, the analysis of what did she actually do outweighed some of these medical issues that are now being discussed and argued. The outweighing was that it took 7 years, and the record is very clear on this, it took 7 years for Ms. Skeens, the appellant, to actually make her first effort at employment. It took 9 years for the second effort at employment.
Ms. Nordon, if I can jump in here, because I think when we're talking about the efforts made, I want to make sure I understand what was pre-2014. Sure. And potentially subject to some kind of collateral estoppel argument, or distinguish that from what was post-2014. And specifically, starting point for me, the starting point is, what does the district court rely on? And then if the district court is relying on, excuse me, if the district court's relying on something that's pre-2014, how was the decision in 2014 different from the decision in the instant order? So when you're referring to those, it seems both of those are post 2014. You're talking about.
They are, Your Honor. They are both post 2014. Here's the difference, Your Honor. In 2014, what was before the court was simply a modification motion. It is true that my client raised the issue of whether or not there was an obligation as of that time to be at least partially self-supporting. However, the lower court said, that's not before us in 2014. The distinction here, Your Honor, is that when Judge Brown, the trial court in this matter, had presented and reviewed prior to 2014 efforts, she was looking at the entire term. And it wasn't that she was saying that Ms. Skeens should have been employed as of 2014. She was saying she had had 12 years, including that time before 2014. So I do not think that the collateral estoppel applies here, because in 2014, the court really was not considering any modification based upon a valid argument that she should have met her duty.
Ms. Nordon, I'm going to jump in just for a minute, because I noticed that the video for Judge Wheelock cut out. So I'll ask you to go back and repeat your answer to the question. Were explaining why it's a different question before the court in 2014 than the question today. The imputation of income in 2014 different from the decision that we're reviewing. Is that fair?
That's fair, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the issue before the court in 2014 was simply a modification motion. It didn't mean that my client didn't raise the issue of whether or not she should have been striving for self-support by that point. But I believe that the court correctly said it's not before us. Okay. So it didn't resolve what is the implication of those years between 2008 and 2014 in terms of the efforts that should have been made. And the lower court in 2021 is saying, I'm looking at the entire time frame here that the appellant actually had 12 years to do something. Okay. And she chose not to do anything for 7 years. And then she didn't do anything again for 9 years, both unsuccessful efforts. And I think it's also important to realize that between that ninth year and the 12th year, there's absolutely nothing in the record of any effort, education, job, et cetera. So we have a 12-year time frame. It was supposed to be originally 14 years. And we have a case where there is a strong intent that both of these parties intended that that would be it. Okay. And, you know, we've got two parties here. My client fully expected that come December of 2020, he would be done providing for support. He had relied upon that. He had paid significant support. And the counsel for appellant has raised the issue, well, is it fair because she didn't get, I think the claim is 300 some thousand of what was originally intended in that 14-year term of 7,000 and 6,000. Well, the reality is my client had a substantial change when he lost a job. And the case law is very clear that the obligee is also to experience that same hardship. It's not a one-way street here. So to argue that that in any way should be a reason for continuing spousal maintenance is not correct. And so, Your Honor, I do realize that, you know, we have this 2014 case and appellant is arguing the collateral estoppel, but I think there's such a strong distinction. And that this is a decision that fully reviews the term and says, you had 14 years. You had every opportunity to actually do something here or show us you tried to do something. You know, it's that case of whether or not the effort was such that it showed an effort versus not putting forth an effort. And that's our situation, is that the reasonable efforts are not existent. And those that happened failed. And she did little or nothing. She really relied upon the continuation of that spousal maintenance. And I think that's shown in the last 3 years that, you know, we have a report prepared for this proceeding, for that motion. We have medical reports that started in 2014, but there was never a motion until right at the end of the term for extending it based upon medical. So that's what we're looking at. And the lower court spent a great deal of time reviewing that entire record, including the medical, and, you know, looking at the vocational evaluation. There's findings 57 through 82 that deal strictly with why is the court finding the medical records, the vocational evaluation, not credible in this matter. Footnotes 20 to 33. So we have a lower court that spent a lot of time and yes, imposed her feelings, her opinions, but they're based upon actual records before her and an analysis before her. And those detailed findings, both parties here have cited the detailed findings in our briefs. And as I said, how often do you have that kind of detail? One of the issues raised in appellant's brief in terms of why was the vocational evaluation found not credible, because basically it's, you know, it's based upon the medical records. Well, what the judge said in the lower court was it's also based on the reporting of appellant. And there's really two facets to that. And that also includes her own affidavits. The facets are her self-reporting of her functioning and her self-reporting of what happened with two job efforts she made. And those are two of the factors relied upon by the vocational evaluator. He actually relies upon the doctor's report from earlier in 2020 as being the statement that she's not employable. And then his own testing says that she functions in the average to lower area. That's not functioning, that's average to low. So those are all aspects that the lower court reviewed in detail, extreme detail. As for
if I can jump in and ask a question about the need-based fees, I see the time is running down, and so I'll be very much to the point. It seems that the district court makes a finding that wife did not make good faith efforts at rehabilitation, or did not make good faith efforts to secure employment. But that strikes me as slightly different than whether or not the motion to modify is made in good faith. Whether there's a good faith assertion of someone's rights seems to be different. Do you think that the district court conflated those things, or are they the same thing in this case?
I think that in finding that one aspect of the statute is not met, specifically the good faith assertion, what the lower court was doing was really finding bad faith. The lower court felt, it's very clear, that the motion was improperly before the court because of the lack of effort. That's the bottom line, the lack of effort that was made by appellant over those 12 years, and her complete reliance upon the spousal maintenance continuing. So I believe that the judge was saying that this motion should never have been brought because the efforts of the appellant to meet her burden in terms of rehabilitation were not met. So, Your Honor, with that, we are asking that the order be completely affirmed.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Hunt, rebuttal?
Yes. There is no question there is an extreme amount of findings of fact in this case. But as detailed in the briefing to this court, the findings are often very redundant and they are clearly erroneous. Appellant has set forth in detail why, based on the record before the trial court, the findings are not in accord with the record. What is noticeable is that the respondent never responds to that in his brief. He just parrots back the trial court's findings. And for the reason that appellant has gone through in detail in appellant's brief, there is an abuse of discretion here. I want to refer to Judge O'Fallon's 2014 order and its effect. If the court looks at finding 15 and Judge O'Fallon's order at addendum 112, the trial court says the parties did not anticipate a change in her ability to support herself between 2008 and 2014. Her employment situation has not changed, and there's no evidence that the parties anticipated that it would. Now, that is a finding by the trial court. So, but what does the trial court now do in 2020? The trial court, in large respects, says that there's bad faith and that all these bad things about the appellant for the time period before 2014, even though Judge O'Fallon in 2014 says no, that this is how the parties were to operate. So that is clearly erroneous and it has a big impact on what the trial court ultimately rules in this case. Respondent likes to talk about the stipulation. And there's no question that there was a stipulated judgment decree. There was one in Hecker. But what happened in this case is that the stipulated judgment and decree, as far as spousal maintenance, kind of went out the window once the respondent came in and was able to assert that he should pay less, and he was allowed to with the trial court's blessing. But even when appellant came back to the trial court in 2014 and said now reinstated, it wasn't reinstated to the level that it was supposed to be under the stipulated judgment and decree. It was supposed to be at $7,000 a month at that point. Instead, the trial court put it at $6,000 a month. So the idea that respondent can come into court and claim substantial change in circumstances, but appellant somehow it has the inability to do so and somehow did so late, has no basis in the law or fact. And finally, with regard to the what the evidence is as to ability to work. I mean, the fact of the matter is the her appellant psychiatrist states unequivocally to the vocational assessor who calls the treating psychiatrist, and this is at addendum page 127, and the psychiatrist says that she has this overwhelming anxiety that she cannot work. Now, there's nothing that contradicts that. So the idea that the trial court somehow reads these medical records and reaches a result that she can work, even though the treating psychiatrist says she can't, has no basis in the record. And I have presented the court with cases. They're out of the federal court system, but they're interesting because often the federal courts are dealing with disability and mental illness. And the federal courts have been very concerned when you start cherry picking medical records when someone has mental illness. And that's what happened here. The trial court cherry picked the medical records to reach a result that the records simply don't support, and that appellant's treating psychiatrist specifically refutes. So on this record, and even though I know there's massive findings of fact, the trial court did abuse its discretion because the findings do not square with the record before the court. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let me thank both attorneys for their arguments today and their written submissions. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.